Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. I am privileged to have as a friend and colleague a man who has devoted his entire professional life to protecting the country we love, pursuant to an oath of office that he swore many times against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and who has just made a very important fact-finding mission to a place that's likely to become a flashpoint of very great importance to our country's security and its ability, most especially, to project power in its defense. That would be Panama. And our guest would be Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, a man who has not only served his country with distinction in the uniform of the United States Army among its special forces elements, but also has been a top civilian in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, specializing particularly in cyber warfare and related matters. He's a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and a great contributor to this program. We're always glad to have him, especially on the, the moment, basically, when he has just returned from this fact-finding mission to Panama. Colonel, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir. Thank you for making the trip, and thank you for coming to report about it.
Oh, thank you, Frank. It was just an absolutely wonderful trip. However, with a lot of concerning findings, and it was an honor to be down there with Michael Yon and Ann Vandersteel, and we did an absolute extensive survey of the canal on the ground, on the water, and in the air, and a number of concerning findings.
Well, tell us a bit about the most concerning of them, John, and what your takes away are.
Well, I think first and foremost, the water levels of the canal are concerning. On the surface, it appears that there is, with the new locks, those locks are all worked by the fresh water developed behind Madden Dam and in Lake Gatun, Gatun Lake. And with the new much larger locks, they just consume a lot more water. There seems to be a significant difference between the previous usage and the new usage and the current El Nino dry season. It's bad. It's bad because...
John, just to set the stage for us a little bit. It's my understanding that they widened the canal to accommodate these, I guess they're called Supermax container ships. Is it the same basic canal, or did they expand the canal as well? And how do these locks figure into the operations of the entire complex?
Well, yes, they wanted to make it for 50-foot draft. That is pretty deep. And the new 20,000 TEU, 20-foot equivalent unit and above super container ships need 50-foot draft. They have to reduce it to 42 feet. So they did a lot of dredging, but that's not good enough. They also have new locks on each end that are much wider and much longer. The old Panamax standard was 106 feet, which actually, that was the width that drove U.S. Navy ship design for decades. But our carriers can't pass, our Nimitz and Ford class carriers can't pass, and really our large flat deck amphibious warfare ships can't pass. There's with the old locks, but even with the new locks, the carriers can't pass. But yeah, they did that too, with the presumption of the super post-Panamax ships with 20,000 TEU and above, they're limited to 42 feet. That means these super ships have to come in, unload some of their cargo, freight rail it across on the container trains, and then reload it. That's super inefficient.
Expensive. Obviously. Yeah, yeah. So 42 feet is the water level minimum that these vast ships need. Are they meeting that minimum, John, or is the water level actually less than that?
Well, they need 50 feet, but they've been limited to 42 feet, which means they have
Okay.
to lighten and raise themselves.
Right.
So that
Well,
there was a
presumably, I mean, under that rubric, you could continue to lighten it until everything's going by train, right? So, just give us a sense of how serious this water problem is at the moment, as you see it.
It's a, I would say a crisis level, because it is it, it if they don't get a miraculous rainfall in November and December and January, it's going to drop continue to drop any further. Now, again, on the surface, the story is there's a difference between water needs and what they had planned for. They are working on a second dam and reservoir. And for everybody's memory, the North, Panama Canal actually goes north-south. The Pacific is on the south, the Atlantic's on the north, and we always think it's east-west. Not quite. That it's going to take 5 to 10 years to get that second reservoir into place. Now, again, I'm still concerned, is there potential Chinese cyber tomfoolery reaching in and assisting the greater usage of water. I did put that to several that I met with. I think that's just be that the comprehension of that is kind of beyond what most mortals are used to and normally deal with. So it went right over their heads.
But you've spent a lot of time monitoring and countering Chinese cyber warfare, so this is something that would be an obvious play if they want to interfere with, for example, the use of our military vessels to get from the Atlantic Ocean into the Pacific in time of war, most especially. That would not result in the canal being destroyed, that would simply make it unusable for such a purpose, right?
Right. And this would presume the Panama Canal Commission is Panamanian controlled. A lot of people say, oh, it's Chinese controlled. That's not true. There are Chinese interests at each end and throughout. This is a, they are they want control of everything. They would like to have control of the canal. They want control of the water management contract, which is not yet awarded. But you know, noticing that extra seepage through the IP enabled network, which monitors this whole system and process, presumes you know what to look for. And if you just tweak that dial a little bit, it's almost imperceptible that somebody's tweaking that dial a bit and accelerating the loss of water. I just don't think this is something that has entered their thought pattern down there, that the Chinese may be helping.
So, John, I know you've been sufficiently concerned about this for some time. This concern has obviously been reinforced by your on-site inspection. To the extent that there is a, well, shall we say, problematic Chinese presence and influence, especially if they're actually engaged in cyber warfare, but even if they're just physically present and in a position to control both ends of the canal, what is your principal recommendation for the United States in terms of enhancing our own presence there or otherwise trying to counteract that of the Chinese?
Oh, and one factoid I noticed, there is a Chinese company which enables airspace security over the canal. I'm not going to name the company right now, but that factoid was extremely concerning. So they help with the radio frequency using that to help shield the canal. Very concerning. But the answer to this is a passionate US ambassador advocating, please sit down, everybody, America first values. We don't have
Wait a
that
minute,
right
John,
now.
we have to take a break. I want to come back to how far from that standard we are. I think most of us expect, well, of course, that's what our ambassador would do and be about. And if that's not the case, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. John Mills is in the house. We'll be right back with Colonel Mills. Stay tuned for more right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. History's greatest crime against humanity is happening now. In fact, the vicious persecution of more than 350 million Christians gets worse by the day, and little is being done even to decry, to say nothing of ending it. Just last week, Sharia supremacists in Azerbaijan, no longer content with deliberately starving 120,000 Armenian Christians in a region known as Nagorno-Karabakh, violently invaded their ancient homeland. Terrified that a resumption of an Ottoman Empire-style genocide will befall them next, virtually every man, woman, and child is now desperately trying to flee. Washington did nothing to discourage, let alone prevent, such intensified persecution. Influenced by the jihadist Muslim Brotherhood, virtually silent Biden officials, including USAID Director Samantha Power, who actually wrote a book expressing regret about her previous failure to prevent genocide in Rwanda, have effectively encouraged it. Never again? Not. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired. He is reporting on an on-site inspection that he and two other great Americans, Ann Vandersteel and Michael Yon, performed in recent days in Panama, specifically looking at the strategic Panama Canal, its current operations, problems it is confronting, and not least, the perilous presence of the Chinese Communist Party's elements in that immediate arena, and what that might mean for all of us. John, you were talking about the extent to which we have an urgent need for an aggressive pro-American ambassador on the scene in the United States Embassy in Panama. Are we short of that mark at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. Ambassador Ponte. Okay, I'll be forgiving of her bio, but it indicates some left-wing leaning. Okay, so I'll just put that aside. But the top priority has been essentially transgenderism. I mean, literally, that appears to be the public highest priority. We were able to stop the Chinese building of the second bridge, that the Bridge of the Americas, the classic huge Bridge of Americas, is sorely in need of a replacement, a new bridge. We were able to stop the Chinese, but we haven't proffered an alternative. And this is where we need to passionately get American companies, Bechtel, Parsons, Jacobs, AECOM, down there to provide an alternative. So we just can't shame them and tell them, don't use those Chinese companies. We've got to give them an alternative.
Right.
And that's an example of presumably a presence on the public sector as well as the private sector side. You have in the past, John, recommended, as I recall, the Army Corps of Engineers possibly bringing expertise on this water management problem, among other things. The Chinese haven't gotten that contract for water management yet. They may be mismanaging it through cyber. But talk a little bit about that public sector role as you see it, and how important it is that we be there in a big way.
Well, I have identified through press reports that the Army Corps, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, has been brought up in somewhat of a role. That was actually news to several of the Panama Canal officials that I had met with. They're kind of keeping this low key. They want Americans back. They really want Americans back, but they don't want a heavy military presence. But we need to get the Army Corps. Would be perfect, kind of an intermediate, more of a humanitarian, technical role. So we're not talking about, you know, warships, helicopters, things like that. That would be a perfect role for us to insert a return and provide great value. Because after that, the handover, there was no requirement that we leave. But we a huge vacuum was created in the 90s, and we just left. And Panamanians are going, where are the Americans? They are very pro-American, very, very pro-American. Maybe a small niche of hard feelings from the invasion. But Noriega was a very, very bad person and killed thousands of Panamanians. So the Army Corps would be great. But we just need a more passionate ambassador. We can't, I mean, literally, transgenderism seems to be their highest priority.
Well, I wish I could say that this is unique to the ambassador in Panama. This is obviously a top priority for the Biden administration, as we saw with the nomination and now confirmation of General C.Q. Brown to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So, John, in terms of the kinds of concerns that you went down there with, namely the Chinese presence and dominance, really, besides the need for both private and public sector presence on the part of the United States, what else has got to be done, for example, on this water management issue, if it's going to take a decade or so to build up an additional sort of reservoir to help meet that need? As I understand it, part of the problem is that if the fresh water goes into making those locks operate, that's fresh water that isn't available for drinking for the
Exactly.
population. And that sounds like it's a pretty critical issue in its own right, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, not to use a UN term, but there is essentially, this is like a crisis in progress, and with the lead time needed for that second reservoir, it just the mathematically it's not going to work out. So we need to move from a run to almost a sprint to do something now. To because if it starts to hit, 40, 35 feet of minimum draft, that's not going to work out. That's not going to work out at all. So we really need them, and the ambassador, and so that is that. It would be a huge help. The Panamanians would appreciate that, and would serve great value. But basic things, the Panamanians do not have they don't have a good sewage system. Everything dumps right into the ocean. They would appreciate a modern sewage system. They don't have a postal address system. Without simple things like that, we just take for granted. A number of these functional governance activities that would be perfect for civil affairs activities of the U.S. military. So functional
And
governance.
again, restoring our presence in that very critical region. John, I think these are such important insights. I look forward to further, reporting by you on recommendations and hopefully to work with our Committee on the Present Danger of China to implement those recommendations as well. Let me ask you about one other issue. You had, in addition to your good self, of course, two experts really on the border problem. I think you've been scoping that out with the help of Michael Yon and Vander Steele as well. John, a quick takeaway on where we are with respect to what I think unmistakably now is a full-on invasion of this country.
Yeah, there are 3,000 to 5,000 a day of illegal migrants coming through Panama. That is crushing the Panamanian economy, and they are paying for most of this out of pocket. So this is a horrible condition. There is actually very little U.S. funds. We're encouraging this, but we're not paying for it, and we're crushing the Panamanian economy. There are absolutely Chinese paramilitaries coming through as part of that, but that's 24 buses for every 1,000. So at 3,000, that's 72 buses a day heading north. This and not everybody's heading north. There's some that are filtering off, and they can't absorb this many refugee, or I don't want to call them refugees, but these illegal migrants. And they are actually building a road through the Darien Gap. That Darien Gap was intended to be a buffer for medical reasons, for security reasons. I mean, 100 years ago, that was supposed to be a forested gap to protect North America. And they are actually, Colombia and Peru and others are building a road through the jungle.
With, as I understand it, our tax dollars helping to underwrite it as well. To the extent that I can pivot to just one last topic with you very quickly, John, I did want to ask you, you've been very concerned, again, as an Army guy, about shipbuilding in our country. There has been a recent report that the Chinese have, as I recall, 230 times the shipbuilding capacity of our country. What do we do about that, John?
Here's another crisis, and this has been pointed out for years. Just a total lack of strategic thought, operational art, and ability to execute on the Navy staff. Now, there is a positive attribute, the Maritime Administration, which is done very well in shipbuilding, but which has earned them, they've effectively been shadow banned by big U.S. Navy. But the Maritime Administration now been given a role in developing the maritime strategy for America.
We need a strategy for sure, but it sounds like we also need more capacity. John, we'll have you back to talk about all of that and its national security implications, which are very significant indeed in the near future. Thank you, my friend. Thanks for your report. Thanks for making the trip. Thanks for staying well, as we need you very desperately here. We'll talk with you soon. We'll be right back with more right after this. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're going to have a very, well, troubling conversation now with a woman I admire greatly. Her name is Lauren Homer. She's an attorney by training, has become one of, I think, our country's preeminent champions of religious freedom, and is now the president of an organization devoted to it called the Law and Liberty Trust. You can find out all about it at lawandlibertytrust.org. She has been active in the international religious freedom battle space, notably trying to help minimize what is a scourge of unprecedented dimensions, the persecution of Christians. By some estimates, there are some 360 million who are being heavily persecuted all around the world. We're going to talk with her today about a spot in the Caucasus that has become a flashpoint for the persecution of Christians, a little area known as Nagorno-Karabakh that has been surrounded by Azerbaijan, but populated by Armenian Christians. And we're going to catch up with Lauren about what has happened there in recent days and what it portends. Lauren Homer, welcome to Securing America. It's great to have you with us. And thank you for the work that you do in this space. It's vitally important, as you know.
Tell us so much about
Nagorno-Karabakh.
Well, Nagorno-Karabakh, as you said, is a small enclave, physically located in the middle of the country of Azerbaijan, but in every sense part of the country of Armenia. Armenians have lived there and in the territory of what is now considered to be the nation of Armenia for 6,000 years. They are the indigenous people in this region, and they are the first Christian nation Believe it or not, they're the first nation that adopted Christianity as the state religion very early on. And they have been relentlessly persecuted, most notably, though not only, by the Ottoman Empire. In 1915, there was a genocide in which hundreds of thousands of Armenians were killed in the most brutal ways. And in 2021, our country, President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken, recognized the 1915 Armenian genocide, which produced outrage on the part of Turkey, which views itself as the successor to the Ottoman Empire. But that was 2021. Meanwhile, in 2020, Turkey and Azerbaijan, working as a team, they have the motto, one nation, two countries, had already invaded a part of Nagorno-Karabakh. And the local population, seeing really almost unbelievable atrocities, rapes, beheadings, fled. So in that event, this is 2020, 900,000 people fled to Armenia or other parts of Nagorno-Karabakh. Azerbaijan came in and completely eradicated every trace of Armenian civilization. They destroyed ancient churches, cemeteries, et cetera, et cetera. Fast forward to last December, This was no secret. Both Armenia and Turkey believe that Armenia has no right to exist, and that all of the territory...
Armenia itself, not just Nagorno-Karabakh, is
exactly.
Outlier.
The whole area has no right to exist and should all be part of either Azerbaijan or Turkey. And they've been talking about this since at least 2016. The Ministry of Defense of Turkey has published maps on which Armenia and the nation of Georgia do not exist, and large parts of what is now Russian Caucasus territory is not part of Russia.
Lauren Homer, let me ask you about a comment that I heard from a reporter commenting on what has happened, and I do want you to catched us up to the past few days. But the argument was that it has nothing to do with religion, all of this behavior on the part of the Ottomans in the first instance, the Turks most recently, and of course their allies, the Azerbaijanis. Is that your assessment?
Not at all. I mean, the Armenians are, as I said, a Christian nation. Turkey and Azerbaijan are subscribing to Islamic and Turkic domination in the region. The Ottoman Empire subjugated Armenia in the past and wants to do it again. At one point,
and the techniques that you're talking about, including beheading, of course, have their roots in jihad and Sharia injunctions about how to treat those of other faiths, unbelievers, as they call them. So just do bring us up to the moment, because there's been a lot that's happened just very, very recently.
Absolutely. I'm sorry to sort of digress, but I wanted to set
the historical context is critical.
So starting in last December, Azerbaijan began to besiege Nagorno-Karabakh. Its only real lifeline is a road called the Nalachian Corridor that links it to, you want to call it, mainland Armenia, and which had previously been open and was the major food and other supply route, way people could get to hospitals and so on. So they set up checkpoints under different pretexts, and then starting in July, they cut off all access to electricity, water, food, and the population began to starve. Meanwhile,
meaning they effectively they no longer allowed the use of that Lechin corridor to bring even humanitarian assistance in.
Exactly. Right? A large convoy of International Red Cross trucks was sort of stuck at the border, unable to enter. And this is just to bring food in. And there are many reports of people dying of starvation, women losing, suffering miscarriages, children dying, sick people dying, old people dying. And so probably hundreds, maybe thousands died as a result of this. Meanwhile, they continued to advertise to the world that they were about to invade and take over Nagorno-Karabakh. And this is the Azeris, and all sorts of respected commentators, Genocide Watch, the Lemkin Institute, Luis Moreno Campo, the first ICC prosecutor, all said a genocide is coming.
Yeah. And we did as well with our Save the Persecuted Christians webinar, to which you contributed, and I really commend it to you. Unfortunately, it forecast pretty much what's happening now. Check it out at savethepersecutedchristians.org. So what has transpired just in the past few days, Laura?
So last week on Tuesday, the 19th of September, Azerbaijan invaded Nagorno-Karabakh. Now, parenthetical, Russia is supposed to be the security guarantor for Armenia. They have a treaty by which it's a mutual defense treaty. But Russia announced that it was not going to do anything. So Azerbaijan went in. The day after they went in, the United States suddenly discovered that this was happening and protested, but they did nothing in advance. In fact, they very strongly signaled that they were not going to do anything to stop this. And Azerbaijan came in with superior firepower, wiped out Armenian defenses, and Armenia the next day had to basically say, you can have Nagorno-Karabakh.
So they've surrendered this ancient part of the Armenian homeland, one of the first, as you say, the first nation to embrace Christianity. And is it safe to assume that the Azeris will eliminate any other traces of the Armenian presence or history in that that enclave now that they've begun making it, I guess, Christian Rhine, as the Germans would have put it?
Yeah, they, well, speaking of Germany, it reminds me of something that Hitler said when he was exterminating the Jews. Who remembers the Armenians? And the whole thing is happening again. They have been asked to provide security guarantees if Armenians want to remain in Nagorno-Karabakh and have refused to do so. Instead, they use the term integration, which means assimilating Armenians into Azerbaijan society. Forcibly. There are only 178 Armenians in all of Azerbaijan, which shows that Armenians do not feel that it's a safe place to live and exist. So there are massive efforts by people to leave. The Lechin corridor is still blockaded, and cars are getting through a few at a time. But already, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the latest number, but it's sort of edging up to 8,000 people have escaped. But there are 120,000 Armenians who need to get out. They're not getting medical attention that they need, and they're still starving.
Yeah. Lauren Homer, thank you for this very important report. I hope you'll come back soon with a longer treatment of both what's happened and what is happening and what we must try to do to help at this critical moment. Thank you for your work. God bless you. We'll talk soon. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. History's greatest crime against humanity is happening now. In fact, the vicious persecution of more than 350 million Christians gets worse by the day, and little is being done even to decry, to say nothing of ending it. Just last week, Sharia supremacists in Azerbaijan, no longer content with deliberately starving 120,000 Armenian Christians in a region known as Nagorno-Karabakh, violently invaded their ancient homeland. Terrified that a resumption of an Ottoman Empire-style genocide will befall them next, virtually every man, woman, and child is now desperately trying to flee. Washington did nothing to discourage, let alone prevent, such intensified persecution. Influenced by the jihadist Muslim Brotherhood, virtually silent Biden officials, including USAID Director Samantha Power, who actually wrote a book expressing regret about her previous failure to prevent genocide in Rwanda, have effectively encouraged it. Never again? Not. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are joined by Dr. Stephen Bryan, a friend and colleague of mine of many years, the man we worked together with in the United States Senate and in the Defense Department under President Reagan, and in a variety of other capacities since. He's gone on to be a leader of the defense industry, as well as now a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy. We're very grateful to him for the expertise that is born of all that experience and his insights, which he shares with us with some regularity here. Dr. Bryan, it's great to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
Steve, you've been following closely developments in Ukraine, and I'm always interested in your take on what's happening there, just sort of a ground truth. We've been hearing a lot over the past few months in particular about the Ukrainians mounting a counteroffensive. Whether that is making much progress, if any, is a matter of some conjecture. What's your current reading on the state of play and the prospects for the Ukrainians prevailing in it?
Well, they're not going to prevail in the counteroffensive. I mean, I think that's abundantly clear. They are continuing to attack Russian defenses. Throughout the whole region where the Russians have control, from the northeast all the way down to the southwest. And they keep going at it. They keep losing a lot of men. 17,000 were lost in the month of September. So far, we still have a little bit left in September. 17,000 Ukrainian soldiers. That's a lot. And they're very hard to replace because Ukraine lacks manpower, and it lacks especially trained manpower that has any combat experience. In fact, it was interesting this past week, and this is a Russian claim, but I think it's true. The Russians shot up another Leopard German tank, which is something they've been doing right along. But the crew, two of the three of them were killed outright, and the third one died a little later, are all Germans. Now that has all kinds of implications that have not been answered. But if Germans are actually manning their tanks, it means two things. I mean, one is that the Ukrainians don't have anybody that's qualified that can operate them, which raises a question about these Abrams tanks, which are now arriving. And secondly, why the hell are Germans running anything inside of Ukraine? I mean, why are any foreign troops running equipment for the Ukrainians? It's starting to look like the proxy, Ukraine as a proxy, is becoming an out-and-out war between the NATO, the U.S., and Russia. And that means it'll spread. And that's what we don't really want to see, is that that spread, because that would be a conflagration in all of Europe and could lead to all kinds of outcomes that would be very awful, like nuclear war. So these are things that are very worrisome.
Steve, you mentioned the Abrams tanks. These have been a long time coming. And yeah. I think part of the delay has been that they're supposedly being put into country after Ukrainians have been trained to operate them. Is it your guess that we will find Americans operating those tanks if this German model applies?
Well, if the German thing is correct, it's possible. I mean, there should be enough to operate the initial batch. I think there's 14 tanks coming.
Maybe you say if the German experience is correct, is there uncertainty as to whether they were German personnel?
Well, there's no uncertainty by the Russians. Nobody in the West has acknowledged it. I put out some feelers to the Germans to see if I could find out any more about it. But, you know, to lose three tank crewmen in a battle in Ukraine is not a good thing.
Yeah. And were the Russians able to take the bodies, or were they?
They have the bodies.
They have the bodies. Okay. Yeah.
They interviewed one of them who was wounded badly.
I see.
And then tried to save his life, but apparently failed.
I see.
Whether they recorded that interview or not, I don't know.
Got it. So, Steve, one of the reasons why tanks seem to be faring, among other pieces of equipment, and for that matter, individuals on this battlefield, has been the advent of drones for not only reconnaissance purposes, but also as weapons delivery platforms. Many are of the view that this has really transformed, warfare at the moment. Is that your view? And specifically, is, operating large pieces of armored equipment essentially a death sentence, whoever's manning them?
Not necessarily. I mean, the stuff that's in Ukraine on both sides is conventional the equipment that lacks active defenses, period. Either the U.S. Abrams or the Leopards from Germany or the Chieftains from U.K. or the Russian tanks, for that matter. Now, all of them do not have active defenses, something the Israelis have pioneered and developed with their trophy system, which they now have on their Merkabah tanks.
And when you say active defenses, it means they're passive in the sense that pieces of ordnance are coming at them and they simply diffuse the effects. Is that right? Not something shooting at the incoming, is it?
They have a 360-degree radar on the tank, and they launch a projectile called an unformed rocket, you want to call it that, that intercepts the...
So it actually physically intercepts.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and blows it up. Mm. In fact, there's been a lot of controversy about how do you do that without exposing your infantry around the tank to, you know, being hurt by those explosions. And they seem to have worked that out. And they can put it on tanks. They can put it on infantry fighting vehicles, personnel carriers, even trucks. So it's not cheap, but it works.
But even U.S. tanks do not have this trophy system.
The United States has bought 100 copies of the trophy system for the Abrams tanks, but I think it's mostly to test and learn about it.
Steve, hold the thought. I want to come back to this because this is obviously an important factor
in
survivability. We'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Bryan on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're touring the battlefield in Ukraine with Dr. Stephen Bryan, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and a man who has considerable experience, both leading Finmeccanica US, a very important defense contractor, as well as being in the policy space at the Defense Department, as well as on Capitol Hill. And Steve, you were talking about enhancing the survivability of armored platforms in this very difficult environment in eastern Ukraine. Talk a little bit further about these trophy systems, and 100 of them have been bought by the United States.
100, yeah.
None of them, presumably, on the tanks that are going in.
Oh, no. They wouldn't send those. First of all, I don't think they could be maintained in Ukraine. There's no specialists there that know about the electronics. But it's a very effective system against sort of rocket threats, anti-tank missiles, and against mortars, and against UAVs like the Lancet, which is the Russian one that's been damaging a lot of Ukrainian equipment. It works. Now, it doesn't protect against mines, which is another big threat to tanks. It obviously doesn't protect against artillery rounds. They're too heavy, and they're going to penetrate. And the Russians have used a lot of artillery in Ukraine very effectively against Ukrainian armor. But having said that, if you want a tank force that can survive even the UAVs and the anti-tank missiles, you need to have active defenses on it. And we don't. I mean, practically speaking, we don't.
So is that the only consideration? The Ukrainians are talking about using tanks in sort of special operations. I'm not quite sure what they have in mind.
Well, they mean not
to try to enhance their survivability.
Combat, yeah, because they're getting creamed. So they're, in fact, the head of military intelligence in Ukraine, Budanov, said last week, well, we can't use these in regular, the new Abrams, in regular combat because they'll be destroyed.
Right.
So they're admitting right out it's not possible to use them for that purpose.
Okay. So, Steve, just again, kind of a net assessment here. The two sides have bloodied each other terribly. The Ukrainians, for obvious reasons, just having a smaller population and having suffered tremendous casualties, are disadvantaged. The use of these sophisticated pieces of equipment is limited at the very best. Does that simply result, as you see it now, in a requirement for a kind of ceasefire in place and a pause in the fighting that that may resume at some point in the not too distant future?
Well, yeah.
But, are the options under these circumstances, sir?
Well, that would be an option if the Russians accepted it, but the Russians say no, they won't accept that. They will be happy to negotiate while the fighting continues, but they're not going to go for a ceasefire or a standstill of anything like that until there's a solution to the main issues, which, you know, I understand their position. They're not losing the war. They're winning the war.
They're winning the war simply by continuing to hold territory that...
That's right. And they're doing a lot
Ukrainian
of damage
hands.
To Ukraine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
a tremendous amount of damage, including, I guess, to what's left of the electrical grid there.
Which, well, they're going after it again. Now they're going after the grain, the grain elevators and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Railroads, airfields, infrastructure, generally speaking.
What do you make of the claims by the Ukrainians that they've been able to shoot down much of the ordnance that's been sent their way? Is this damage done notwithstanding what they're doing in that regard?
Either the Russians have more than what the Ukrainians say they have, and so they're saturating, or the claims are false. And I think most of the claims are false.
Really?
Yeah, I understand why they have to, because look, if they say they're being blasted away, they're telling their own people they can't defend their territory.
Yeah.
So they're going to put out outrageous claims, and you just have to write them off. Don't pay attention.
Yeah. So, Steve, Brian, what's the way forward as you see it in Ukraine?
I think that NATO and the Russians have to sit down and work out a general peace that covers Europe. I don't think the Ukrainians have anything to say about it, frankly. If the Ukraine can't get weapons from the West, they have to concede. So I think the real issue is between NATO and Russia. And I think it's in everyone's interest to see if there's a possibility of accommodating Russian security needs, so they claim to have these needs, with Western requirements for security as well, and see if it can be done, see if such a negotiation is possible. The problem right now is that, and it has been throughout this whole war, even before the war, is that the United States especially has not wanted to negotiate with the Russians on any at all. They just want to put sanctions on them, and punish them, try to get regime change and do all this nonsense, none of which has panned out, except to destroy things which are troublesome for the future, like destroying the Nord Stream pipeline, things of that sort. Maybe they're trying to get the Turk Stream one too. So I think what we're really seeing is that sort of strategy has not paid off. It doesn't work. It's just going to get worse, and the war could spread. And it's really time to see if we can sort it out with the Russians. I don't know if we can. I wouldn't be 100% certain by any means, but we should try.
Steve, it raises the question, and in a way your answer just suggests it, that Putin is not going to be satisfied with anything that would be acceptable to NATO, which suggests that, among other things, Putin has ambitions beyond Ukraine.
That's one of the claims.
Wider, you know, ambitions within Ukraine as well. Yeah. Is that your view?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the lessons for Putin of this war is that this kind of conflict is very costly to Russia, and not an easy one to win.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. We've seen that playing out in Technicolor, and it's one that the question is that persuading him that he will not pursue such warfare in the future? We'll be watching this space closely with your help. Stephen Bryan, thank you for joining us today and for your assessment of both the technical and the geostrategic aspects of this war.
My pleasure.
We'll be following it with your help. God bless. We'll be right back. No, we won't be right back. I hope the rest of you will join us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.